is a great help. Also, in the humor quality, we have cheerfulness. And cheerfulness is a natural temperamental asset which will cause us generally to look for good in something. It may get a little platitudinous, it may wear thin in spots, but at the same time, the generally cheerful attitude, not a frozen cheerfulness that ignores difficulty, but one which takes difficulty in stride and decides that in spite of the clouds that are hanging over at the moment, the sun is still shining somewhere, and we might as well begin thinking about that sun instead of those clouds. This sense of humor, this cheerfulness, this natural desire to see the good in things and the happiness in things is very valuable because it helps us to keep out of trouble, and if we're in it, it does seem to make it easier to get out and also easier for other people to help us out if the emergency should arise. We find that humanity in general favors the cheerful person and is more willing to go out of their way to help them. Now, the opposite of this is the melancholy soul. And melancholia is usually a phase of neurosis. The melancholic person is the one who has managed to gradually sell himself a totally negative bill of goods. He has managed to impress upon his own nature the futility of life, the innumerable evils of existence, and has gradually destroyed all sense of adventure, all sense of acceptances of the different situations of living. There's no person who is in a more desperate situation than one who is completely sorry for himself. He not only is a burden to his own life, but he is futile in his effort to make any valuable contribution to any other phase of life. So as melancholia comes along, it should be regarded as a definite symptom of psychological illness and should be treated as such. Now, the psychologist tries to tell us just what kind of a person would be a good, normal type for today. I don't agree with the psychologists on all of these theories of adjustment. I don't think there's anything particularly to be gained by trying to assume that the atomic age is one of the most beautiful periods in history. It would seem to me this is just a superficial, a meaningless attitude. Nor would I say that if we adjusted to society as it is, we'd be happy because society isn't happy. And all the adjustments we can make to it wouldn't prevent us from all still sharing in most of the miseries of our kind. I don't think that those are the foundations upon which normalcy can be considered. But psychology does also have some rather broad general statements about things that are more or less obviously true. One is that a person should be very much like a ship on a good deep ocean. He wants to keep off the rocks, that's obvious. But a ship isn't in the bottom of the sea, it isn't in the air overhead. The ship is sailing on a sea. Part of that ship is underwater, invisible. And there is the place where most of the cargo is carried. The ship is therefore balanced between elements. Its upper structure is above water, its tonnage is below water, and it is living on the surface but with certain depth factors involved in its nature. A man has to live upon the surface of the life that he knows. The surface is here and now. The surface is the day with its problems and its conditions. In order to be successful, the individual must, however, have a certain concealed part of his own nature, that which is below surface or behind surface, or, for that matter, from a mystical standpoint, above surface. But it has to be the more or less intangible security for tangible living. And the individual, therefore, cannot afford to drown in a sea of circumstances. Neither can he afford to be unaware of the great element of ocean on which his little ship is sailing. He is trying to direct his course between the world of mind and the world of body. He is trying to live in space and in matter, and he is suspended between these two in a kind of middle distance. Consequently, his normalcy for the average person is his ability to focus these forces, which are both material and mystical, to focus them upon the emergency problem of his daily existence. Somehow there is great importance psychologically in man in his being right at this moment, that all of his agencies, all of his forces conspire or unite or coordinate to make that individual a constructive, normal person today. Now, right here. That in some way that all these other values miss unless the individual is right at this moment in his own existence. Now, there are other moments that went before, and there will be moments that follow after. These have in various ways been accepted as part of his psychic existence. But the individual, if he is right at this moment, at the immediate instant, proves pretty well that he has handled his past wisely, and also proves pretty well that he will be able to confront his future wisely. If he's in trouble now, he's in trouble always. That is the trouble that we find he faces. If he's in trouble now, he didn't get over the past troubles. If he's in trouble now, he's going to give his own miseries as a priceless heritage to his own future, which is going to have more trouble. So there is something very important about working this problem out immediately. And his present condition is in some way the story of himself. His past has made him what he is, and he will make his future according to his own existence. So if he's in trouble now, this is the only time in which a remedy can be factually and practically applied. And what kind of a person is in trouble? A person who is by nature unhappy. He is in trouble. An individual who doesn't look forward to tomorrow with any kind of relish whatever is unhappy and not adjusted. An individual who can't bear criticism, particularly of his own conduct, has something wrong that has to be made right. The person who doesn't know that he can be better tomorrow than he is today is also in trouble. A person who is perfectly satisfied to do nothing and let the days follow each other in an endless course is likewise in trouble. The practical person is the one who takes hold of things now, and as a result of that does not need to escape into the future or defend the past. So defense really has much to do with past action and escape with future action. There are millions of people who live in a kind of psychological utopia. There are better times coming by and by. But I never met one of those people who ever lived to see them. The better times that must come now, or else they will never come. The individual to whom the present is only a sad interlude, an anteroom to some unknown future that could be better, is missing not only now, but destroying the future that he's hoping for. In the same way, a person who lives heavily and miserably upon his own past has indicated that he has found no digestive power within his own psychic nature. He has not been able to transmute anything. He's never been able to outgrow a disaster. The disaster lives, and he is the one who is perishing. The inability to transform the past into something constructive, the inability to sense that in the problems through which we have passed, we find the strength for the solution of these problems. In other words, if we've solved them, we are now free from them. But if we haven't solved them, here they are, waiting as they have always waited, for us to do something about them. To meet this kind of thinking, we have to sit down somewhere along the line and try to figure out just what we are now. Just what kind of people are we? Are we really in the normalcy range? Not only in terms of psychology, but in terms of universal law and purpose. Are we really in a condition to go forward into the next day or the next year of life with a fair certainty that we will be victorious over the common problems of our days? Or are we going forward with the desperate hope that the days are going to change so that we will not have to? Most people are hoping that times will change. They do. They get a little worse all the time, as far as most people can observe. And they will continue to do so until we start getting better, because so-called times are just ourselves moving into tomorrow. If we can't get along with ourselves today, we can do no better tomorrow. In fact, it'll be a little worse because the habits are deepening all the time. So look over the tendencies to defenses and escapes with which you yourself may be burdened. How is your attitude toward the rights of other people? Do you really, honestly, and honorably believe that other people are entitled to every consideration that you consider appropriate to yourself? Do you feel that they should be heard just as much as you are heard? Do you feel that they are entitled to the same patience and understanding to which you are entitled? Do you honestly believe that other people may be better than you are because of their achievements or their dispositions or their temperaments? And if they are better than you are you glad of it? Now, this is a problem. Are you going to instinctively, intuitively reach out and say congratulations, or are you going to let out a deep sniff and say, with everything that you have, they're not any better? If you really knew them, you'd find out just what kind of so-and-sos they really are. We say this simply because we do not wish to acknowledge that other people may be better than we are. And we have now a new wave of literature which is concerned almost exclusively with proving that nobody was any good from the beginning of history. What is this? Just a pure defense mechanism. We are such a miserable, disillusioned generation that we cannot allow ourselves to imagine that there was ever a time when anybody was any better. So our modern theater, television, radio, and literature is simply one vast sniff in which we are, with a certain snicker, suggesting that the only reason we admire anybody is because we don't know them. So are we actually able to handle at least the contemporary phase of this situation? When we hear something unpleasant about a person, is our first thought to come to their defense? Or is our first thought to say, well, that's probably true. Now let me tell you a little more about it. Or that you should have heard what I heard. What is our attitude on this? When we are talking about a person behind their back, do we simply suddenly stop talking and say, we can't say anything unless they're here to defend themselves? You know, that would be an end for a large part of conversation, especially nowadays. When we're dealing with the problems of other people's religions or their faith, Do we look down with pathos upon some poor old orthodox soul because they haven't received the extra illumination that we possess? Are we honestly able to simply realize that each man's path to God is through his own heart, and that the simple person worshiping in a simple way and keeping a simple conviction may be far better than a person who knows much more but does not keep his conviction so well? Are we thinking constantly of how we can make other people seem better, seem more real and more vital? Or are we simply always taking the attitude that in some way the good of every other person is an insult to us, and the misfortunes that have fallen to other people can only remind us how much greater our own have been? This negative situation is really habit-forming and has caused a great deal of trouble. It's just a matter of getting down and trying to think these things through. Because one way of defending our own smallness is to attack the largeness of anyone else. This isn't the answer at all. The answer is to get larger if our smallness is recognized as in our way. If we are interested in some field of activity or move in a group of people with certain special viewpoints or abilities or specialized forms of knowledge, are we sincerely trying to equip ourselves to share in that particular activity? Or are we going to try to bluff along without knowing? Or are we going to take the attitude that some take in the presence of learning, all these learned people don't know anything anyway, they just talk? Now, maybe it's true. I've heard some so-called learned people who talked magnificently for hours and said nothing. It's quite a problem in learning. A great deal of learning is simply a form of intellectual gymnastics. There's no possible doubt of this. But in any particular case, is it true? That's the question. Sometimes we will find that the learned person is learned. Sometimes we will find that the wise man is wise. Sometimes we'll find that the very simple man is wise. These things we cannot tell by any pattern. Are we trying to live by unsemantic generalities? Are we trying to say that everyone who considers themselves learned is a fool in disguise? If we take an attitude like that, we're going to lose an awful lot in life. Are we going to take attitude that all of a certain class are dishonest, that all of a certain profession are crooks? Are we going to take these attitudes? If we do, the chances are 10 to 1 we're going to meet people in all these classes who are fine persons, honest persons, and well-intentioned persons. Are we going to therefore adjust our thinking, or are we going to keep on talking exactly as we did before? How are we thinking these things through? How are we thinking through problems of intolerance, prejudice? How are we working with our emotions and our attitudes as times come along? Do we find that every interference is an insult? Do we find that this tremendous drive to do as we please prevents us from being able to bend to any gracious situation for any other person? Have we forgotten the graciousness of giving of our own attitudes? Are we trying to dictatorially take over whole areas of life where other persons have rights, but where we do not wish to admit these rights? Is there a little sneaky selfishness floating around in here somewhere? Do we want to always be a center of attention? Are we working little conspiracies to keep our children from getting away from home and building lives for themselves? Are we trying in some way or another to make life easier for ourselves always at the expense of someone else? There are times in this pattern when we'll know it. But if it goes into a pathological degree, then we won't know the truth anymore. And the grave danger in all these psychological problems is that the time comes when we are no longer able to know the truth. We have fooled ourselves until we really have converted ourselves to our own foolishness. As soon as this happens, we become practically airtight. Nothing can reach us. No amount of counsel can reach us. Nothing short of a terrible disaster can crack this shell that we have built around ourselves. Sometimes it can't be broken at all during this lifetime. But as we drift along, nursing negations or nursing wrong attitudes, there is always the danger that they will suddenly set in with such tremendous force that we can no longer cope with them at all. The same problem arises with alcohol. Now, there are many, many drinkers who never become alcoholics. They drink, but for some reason, the habit never sets in upon them. Granted, every drinker is a possible alcoholic. And no one knows which one is going to become an alcoholic. But we do know that one who is neurotically unstable is one of the best candidates for alcoholism. All worriers will not become neurotics. But among worriers, there will be many neurotics. And the worrying tendency is one of the things that makes the neurotic possible. So in all these situations, the drinker who never becomes an alcoholic can stop when he wants to. The drinker who becomes an alcoholic cannot. This is the problem, also psychologically speaking. There are worriers who can worry and stop worrying when they please and will do so as long as they live. There are others in whom the habit of worry will gradually build up until they are utterly unable to cope with it. And life will become one terrible, terrifying possibility after another. These people gradually lose all orientation and all ability to face life with any measure of dignity. Now, we cannot say which critical person is going to gradually become the psychotic critic. There is no way of knowing. Except we do realize that the less stability there is in the first place, the more easily it's lost. And the individual whose psychic load is already heavy is the one most likely to finally come under a general neurotic situation. If there is a sufficient measure of objectivity in the personality, however, the neurosis may be avoided. But it isn't safe to assume that any one person is going to be lucky in this. It is far better to remember that we have 50 million neurotics, and therefore that everyone is an admirable candidate and likely to become more and more involved. Now, there are certain philosophical systems, teachings, and ideas that help a great deal with this problem of neurosis. And an individual who has an adequate philosophy of life and begins to believe it has a great many possibilities of escaping from the pressure of mechanisms of all kinds. If he believes in a lawful universe, if he believes that he has to work out his own salvation with diligence, if he believes that he's in the place he has earned for himself and the only way he can get out is to outgrow it, if he really believes these things, he will not be a neurotic. If he actually and honestly feels that the universe in which he exists is a product of good, is wisely governed, and that he is here for a purpose, and that that purpose is right, he has a pretty fair security against most of the troubles of life. If he adds to this that which philosophy so strongly emphasizes in principle, but which unfortunately American philosophy has not emphasized, namely the importance of creativity and the surrounding of his essential program of life with adequate side interests to balance his way of life. If he has interest in music, interest in art, interest in fine things, and at the same time has a fairly adequate central polarity in his job, his work, his family, his home, and things of this nature, he has a pretty good chance of escaping the pressure of neurosis. If, however, he is not reasonably well integrated, he can proceed along foolish lines or be led into foolishness by others and gradually lose this center of security which is essential to him. Normal children, for example, generally speaking, do not psychologically suffer from what might be termed the common circumstances of life. There are a great many families, for instance, in which perhaps through a broken home or through death, children are deprived of some of the intimate association of parents. Sometimes it is necessary for these children to be placed in schools and things of this nature due to the circumstances that factually prevail. Or these children who might have had rather luxurious lives may suddenly be forced to a much more economical way of living. These situations do not normally damage the child. The child is not damaged by facts. The child is damaged by delusions. And as the child grows older, if there was some misunderstanding as to the circumstances, and the child finally sees that the best possible was done, that everyone acted with sincerity, and that all reasonable steps to protect the child's right were taken, the child is seldom seriously damaged. The child is not damaged by normal punishment or correction for real faults. The child is not damaged because it is not overprivileged. The child may feel badly at the moment, but the child is much more apt to be damaged and admit it from many luxuries than from the lack of them. Therefore, the honest relation of facts to people will not normally seriously damage people. The thing that damages is the dishonesty that works into these patterns, the ulterior motives that come out, the selfishness and self-centeredness which the child may not be able to understand but which it feels. Therefore, the sincere person doing the best they can for the child has a good chance of being understood intuitively, if not intellectually, whereas ulterior motive will also sink deep into the subconsciousness of the child and will result in the difficult situation that parents sometimes afterwards cannot understand at all. But the real reason is there was not enough honesty in the pattern all the way through. Too many people were thinking of themselves only, thinking of their own troubles and passing on their own griefs and grievances. There was not a proper sense of unity of thought on the need of the child and the child's rights. So that facts do not generally damage us at any stage of life. But distortions of facts, accepted, these will hurt us and hurt us desperately. And the only answer to the problem of fact is that we must all become fact-finding instruments. Each individual must look for and be able to determine the simple and immediate facts of his own existence. This is not as difficult as it appears to be, because we are endowed by nature with an amazing sensitivity to fact. The individual who simply is quiet, uses his faculties in the way they were intended, will come up with facts 9 times out of 10. The trouble is, the moment the facts come up, the individual resents them, does not want them to be the facts they are, wants them to be something else, because these facts may not be flattering, may not be in accordance with the desires of the person. Therefore, the problem then is how to get out of the facts, how to evade them, or disproportion them, or distort them until they fit our own preconceptions. Always where we do this, we begin to use defense and escape mechanisms in the justification of the attitudes we wish to take on these different situations. Now, the people come in every week with problems. They've been coming for over 40 years now. And these problems are all of them, or nearly all of them, involved in this inability to look straight in our own faces and see what's there. Most of the problems that beset us most desperately are not really problems in the common sense of the word. They are matters of decision. Many times the decision is overdue. Sometimes it is so far overdue that nobody even wants to make it anymore. But nearly always a problem is a decision that has to be faced. And if we can face this decision with a certain amount of reality, the problem will dissolve. So we suggest very strongly that the persons who find themselves hypersensitive, who find themselves getting more and more nervous under the pressure of situations, who are getting fed up on something, who are beginning to take intensive attitudes, that they are not understood, that they're not valued, that they're not appreciated, that they're not cared for, and all of this type of thing, if these people would just settle down, relax a minute, they will not find it necessary to go into the elaborate programs of justification and compensation which appear to be indicated. Because these problems are nearly always solved simply by relaxing. The individual sits back very quietly, and he has the problem that people are not kind enough to him. Well, there are two answers to that, and they're very simple answers. One is, why should they be? Actually, why should anyone be kind to anybody? Only because they want to. Why should they want to? Because they feel like it. And in this generation, very few people feel like it. We are under tremendous tension. The less understanding we have, the worse the tension is. The more understanding we have, the more patient we have to be with the people who don't understand. There is no other answer to this. Therefore, if people do not appreciate us, it may only mean that their minds are on something else. And also, there is this old Socratic idea that actually we don't do things to be appreciated. We do them because they need doing. And most people will appreciate themselves a little, and that will make up for some of the loss as far as other people are concerned. But factually and seriously, it's nice to be appreciated. We all love it. But we can't demand it. Perhaps we honestly believe we deserve it. But still we can't demand it. So if we get it, it's a gracious gesture. If we don't get it, we keep right on. There's nothing else we can do. This is factual. And the moment we start moaning about it, or wondering about it, or feeling bad about it, all we're doing is building up a psychosis. Nature wants us to some way sense, perhaps, that the things that we do that are in conformity to law are right. And their reward is their own rightness. That actually every individual who does good in this world is serving a principle of good. He is not serving other people. And the principle of good will never overlook what he has done. And one way he will find out that it doesn't overlook is the fact that the good he does becomes the basis of the good he is. And nothing that he has done can fail to have its reward in his own consciousness. Therefore, the most important thing in the world, universal life, is forever appreciating him, and is proving this by bestowing its benefits upon him. If, however, for lack of the appreciation of other people who may not have any idea what he's doing in the first place, or wouldn't know whether it was good or bad in the second place, if instead of recognizing this universal life, he clings to his opinion of these people, making his happiness or unhappiness depend upon recognition by others of his own kind, then he must perform such actions as they can recognize. And he probably doesn't want to do that. Because actually, perhaps he feels the things that he is doing are more important. Perhaps they are. But to the degree that they are more important than average things, they will not be appreciated by average persons. So he is working now with a full realization that the moment that he becomes an individual, he must, to a certain degree, sacrifice the applause of the masses. He has to do it. He's got to make a decision. Consequently, his decision is the same decision that Socrates had to make. The decision that it is more important to do that which is right than to be popular. The reward lies in the person having the internal integration to do this. If he has it, he has no problem. If he doesn't have it, then it is his natural problem to attain that end, to make himself understand the real values of things, to make himself capable of recognizing that no matter what others do, whether they understand him or not, his own integration demands that he understand them. And this process of understanding them will almost certainly terminate when it is correctly used in discovering why these people could take no other attitude than the one they did. So to be able to think this through takes us away and out of the barriers of the criticism of people who do not understand, the applause of people who do not understand, and the indifference of people who do not understand. These things are natural. And the person who understands has security because his understanding must tell him these things. If his security isn't there, it means that his own understanding is not perfect in this respect or not advanced far enough to sustain him. It is the same thing with his jealousies and his worries and his fears and his hates. There is nothing in this world of which any person need be afraid. There are problems. There are difficult problems. A man must face life, a man must face death. But there is nothing of which man must be afraid. In order to be afraid, your own psychic integration has to be inadequate. This doesn't mean that you are not mindful, that you are not thoughtful, that you are not saddened by situations in which it is obvious great troubles are likely to lurk. But this does not permit the thoughtful person to panic, nor can it cause the thoughtful person to lose sight for an instant of the universal plan which lies under these things and which must fulfill itself. And that good shall come where it is not deserved is not reasonable or right. Therefore, if certain problems arise, they must be faced and met for the good of all concerned, even as the child must be corrected or its character will be damaged. So the individual does not have to be afraid. He does not have to criticize others. He does not have to feel neglected or forlorn or alone. He does not need to be melancholy over anything, because the problems that face him are natural problems which can be handled by natural means if he will not distort them with imagination. It's always to keep the facts straight. And that is the simple way by which we preserve our own mentalities. The moment the thoughts get out of order, our basic mind begins to lose its integration. And if we permit all kinds of confusion to take the place of fact, the mind is unable to bear confusion beyond a certain degree. And under constant confusion, it begins to break. It shows too much exhaustion. And the person of today does not exhaust the mind by its use. He exhausts it usually by abusing it. He exhausts it by burdening it with comparatively worthless problems, by involving it in meaningless controversies, and by exhausting its resources in the maintenance and defense of emotional excesses. If the mind is cleared from these things, it can think straight. Now, the emotional nature of man is also involved in nearly all of the complexes and pressures which affect him. And this is true also of his escape and defense problems. The emotional nature of man is tied very closely, for instance, to the emotional impulse to run away from a situation, to panic, or to have all kinds of involved feelings about things, great bursts of feeling one way or another. These emotions simply feed pressure. They build up pressure, and they interfere with the ability of the individual to handle his own mental problems in reasonable and rational ways. So the thoughtful person, the wise person, realizes that his understanding, his patience, his ability to think through things, these are constant defenses against his emotions. The minute he cannot cope with a situation mentally, he becomes emotional. But when he can quietly recognize justice and cling to it, emotion isn't involved in any strong way. When he sees truth, emotion is quiet. When he becomes involved in untruth, emotion flares. So that wherever we have defenses and escapes, we have a powerful emotional pressure. But if we have quiet solution, the emotions rest, bestowing upon us only the enrichment of our constructive attitudes. Emotions taking our friendship warms it. Our understanding lightens it. All these things the emotion can accomplish gently. But the moment the mind goes off the track and becomes pressure-ridden, it drags the emotions with it. And the emotions become turmoiled by the insecurities, the inconsistencies, and apparently the injustices of life. So we can get very emotional over these things. Whereas our emotions should be reserved very largely for our appreciation, for our genuine admiration of the wonder of life itself, and our adoration for the great Creator of all good things. Our emotions should be constructive, not destructive. But if we are not able to give the mind emotional support and the emotions mental support, we are unable to accomplish this end. Therefore, our emotions vitalize our escapes and our defenses, and this leads us more rapidly into a psychotic condition. Now, no, most persons are certainly not in a situation where they're not able to control these things. But most persons are not in a condition in which they are getting the maximum support from their own minds and emotions. There are some habits by which we are wasting or draining off energy to support notions, opinions, complexes, or fixations, or in which we are using energies to support our weaknesses rather than to correct our weaknesses, or are using energy to tear down other persons' virtues rather than building our own. So wherever there is a waste of energy, we have a tendent lack of efficiency and gradual depletion of vitality. Whereas the proper use of energy is a continual exercising of the energy factor. An energy rightly used renews itself. Wrongly used exhausts itself. To keep our energies, to keep our peace of mind, our poise, and our happiness, therefore, we must neither run away from anything or defend ourselves when we are wrong. Instead of building defenses and escapes, we must gradually insist upon the immediate solution of problem by fact. This is the kindly thing. The most loving thing in the world is the truth. And when we try to love people by protecting them from the truth, we do very little good. We must protect them for the truth, and we must inspire them with the truth in their own consciousness. These things lift our responsibilities. A few simple concepts, and we set another person upon a straight way of life. Whereas if they live with us through years of our own evasions and intemperances, they have gained nothing and perhaps have lost a great deal of ground. So we say that the problem of the escape mechanism, the defense mechanisms, these are problems which we can solve by sitting down quietly and saying to ourselves, is there anything that can make us create this defensive attitude or force us into a panic to escape? Is there anything we're running away from? Is there anything we're building an artificial defense against? If these exist, think them through, work them out, and if the knowledge is inadequate, gain new knowledge so that the individual can live without being afraid of any pressure, but able to accept pressure quietly, transform it into experience, and grow with it or by it into the next step of his own life. If he does these things, he will be pretty safe against the neurotic dangers of the so-called polar mechanisms, the mechanisms which affect adversely the lives of most human beings. Well, I guess that's all for this evening, folks.